Hello and welcome to this week's Investors Chronicle Alpha podcast. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined as always by Phil Oakley. How are you doing, Phil?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks, John.
And what do you make of the crazy goings on the markets this week, which is the subject of your Alpha report introduction?
Not much, really, is the truthful answer.
Seen it all before, eh, Phil? Seen it all before.
Well, you and I have.
We have. I wrote as much in my editorial this week. I party like it's 1999. It has a very familiar feel to it, what's going on at the moment.
Yeah, it does. It does, you know. People punting shares of companies that make no money. And there's more to it than that, though. Although that's what people tell me, there's more to it. And I think there is a serious message from all this. And you know, clearly what's been going on, there have been, or it appears there have been, orchestrated attempts to drive the share price of GameStop, AMC Entertainment as another one, higher. Supposedly to target short sellers and make them feel the pain. And there are some hedge funds that have felt the pain. But I think whatever you think of hedge funds, and, you know, I'm not their best fan.
No, there's a great quote you've actually used in your report this week. The bastardized Winston Churchill quote: "Never has so much been made for so little by so few." I think that's very apt.
Yeah. You know, I'm not going to go on about it, but you know, I think they a lot of them can't really demonstrate that they have a lot of skill. They have a lot of borrowed money and leverage. But you know what? You know, the Warren Buffett experiment with an S&P 500 tracker, you know, showed that most of them actually aren't very good, but a lot of them are very rich because of the fee structure. And I can understand quite clearly why some people don't like them. I think what concerns me is that some of the pain that the hedge funds were taking was so big that there's been chatter, and there still is chatter, that they will have to sell more liquid holdings to cover their losses, and you know that is putting downwards pressure on the stock market. So yet again, we have, you know, an instance where the structure of something in the financial world destabilizes the stock market, and I think it's long overdue that you know, I'm a fan of free markets. I believe in free markets and allowing price discovery through, you know, buyers and sellers, but we don't have that. We have a very strange setup. We have too much speculation with borrowed money, and there's a lack of control in certain areas of the stock market. And I think it's long overdue that you know, the powers that be step in on this and do something about it.
Yeah, well, there's been a bit of a backlash because, I mean, a lot of sort of inexperienced traders have started trading throughout the pandemic using Robinhood as a platform, as a trading platform, for their first investments. And my understanding is that's free trading. The whole thing is very, very gamified, offers leverage, derivatives, whatever it might be. Arguably not a tool that, or some of those tools should not be available to people who aren't very experienced. And it sucked a lot of people into the market who don't seem to know what they're doing and how the stock market works. And then obviously you have the social media impact of this as well. So, you know, I look at this and think there's been huge manipulation through what is essentially a bulletin board, Reddit, to bring all those people into to buying shares like GameStop or AMC. That's collusion. And you know, my understanding is that you know, that's not allowed. It's pump and dump, which is certainly illegal over here. And finally, you know, obviously the you then had Robin Hood stopping people buying shares in these companies that had been first heavily shorted and then heavily bought, whilst others could still sell their positions, including hedge funds. So there's now been accusations chucked around that Robin Hood is against the private investor, having democratized the whole thing in the first place. It's a mess.
Yeah, I think you summed it up pretty well. It is a mess.
I mean, I can't see how regulators can't look at this and think, okay, this has gone a bit wrong. We've probably got to do something here. I mean, I don't think even during the wildest times of the dot-com boom, we saw anything quite like this.
I don't remember anything like this. I mean, you remember silly valuations being attributed to essentially worthless companies that did turn out to be worthless. But never this kind of coordinated, you know, would you say it is pump and dump? Or close to pump and dump.
Well, I guess it's only close to pump and dump if people can actually dump, and I think that would be the problem that I think a lot of the, you know, newly wealthy GameStop investors will find they have.
This is an issue that, you know, is not just confined to the, you know, the American stock market. There's a lot of ramping of illiquid shares on this side of the Atlantic as well. But it's not having, you know, it's not having the secondary effects. You know, it's not putting what deemed are, you know, the financial elites, the hedge fund managers, into difficulties. So over here, it's not having that big secondary effect. But you know, I think we have to look at short selling. I'm very old fashioned. I don't agree with short selling. I totally get the argument that short sellers do very, very diligent research and expose problems with companies. But I just think it causes too many problems. I think you can have price discovery in markets without, you know, people lending shares to other people to sell and then buy back. I think you can have price discovery by people who own shares selling shares because they find something wrong with it, or, you know, people trying to sell shares, they realize they can't sell them at the price they want, and then they drop the price and the market clears. Now, that may be a little bit naive, but that is how I feel. And I just think we need to get away from this environment where there are certain participants in the stock market that have the capability to destabilize it.
I'm not 100% convinced that in this instance, I mean, certainly some of the short selling research firms that have been involved in this, Citron was the one whose name is front and center here. But obviously you've got people like Muddy Waters as well, Gotham Capital. You know, I don't see that they're particularly destabilising in and of themselves. And in fact, I do see them serving a useful purpose as being sort of, you know, the canaries in the coal mine. There's some really quite dodgy companies that probably shouldn't have found their way onto the market at all, ever, and then should have probably been kept a closer eye on by regulators. So you could argue that they do a good job. I don't think going after a defunct or an ailing retailer is necessarily doing the market a great service, but you've had some really odd situations that these companies have exposed. Do you see a value in that?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You know, it's and I think, you know, if you just look at the way that, you know, you have research from investment banks. You know, that kind of research doesn't get written by investment banks because, you know, you don't last very long if you write research like that. And because that doesn't bring money into your investment bank. No, they do. I think just to clarify this destabilizing effect is that, you know, you get a problem when you have a short seller that if you have a short seller that's facing a squeeze, and they haven't got the money to cover their losses, then they can be a problem. You know, because usually, you know, there's somebody else that's a counterparty to that trade. Now, we haven't got there yet, and hopefully we don't. But that's what I mean by the potential to destabilize. But yes, they do. There is some very good critical research. I think a lot of it, you know, we have a problem with the quality of companies that are listed on the stock exchange. You know, that you have companies that really should be in the hands of venture capitalists, privately owned, that shouldn't be listed. I mean, you know, when you and I started out doing this, you know, you used to have to have a record of profitability. So to join the main market, you used to have a track record of profitability before you could list your shares on the stock exchange. And now we have, you know, companies listed on the markets across the world that are worth hundreds of billions of pounds that are barely profitable.
One of which is Tesla. Which you've also written about this week, and I know you were keen to speak about. And it kind of, this is another. It's not dissimilar to the GameStop situation, is it? I mean, there have been all sorts of controversies around Elon Musk, the founder's behaviour over the years. I think he even got sanctioned by the SEC at one point for something he tweeted. But you know, this is a strange situation again. You know, the shares, which I think Mr. Musk had once said were overvalued, significantly lower price than they are now, have gone through the roof. I think it trades something like 200 times forecast earnings. I think I read somewhere that, you know, for the market cap per car of Tesla is measured in the millions, whereas you compare that to General Motors and it's something like $9,000. I guess Tesla is the sort of litmus paper of bubble at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, this is not a company I've really, really had a hard look at until this week, actually. I spent quite a few hours looking at it this week, which is, and you sort of get the feeling, yep, okay, I can see the vision of this company. For me, it's a car company. It's not a technology company. It has technology, but it's selling cars.
Well, that's the Scottish Mortgage argument, that it's a technology company, and it's one of their biggest holdings. And their argument is that actually the rest of the industry has so far to catch up because of Tesla's sort of lead on software and whatever it might be, that it is a tech company.
I would totally disagree. I think if you look at, if you, you know, I'm sure that they have spent many, many more hours on this than I have. But, you know, I look at the products that they're selling. So you know, you've got the cars, and we'll come back to the cars. They have things like energy storage, solar panels. They're not making, you know, they're selling them. You know, they're selling more energy storage. They're not making any money out of it. You know, that you can get that from looking at the accounts. There's no, very little, if any, profit from selling those. The batteries, yes, you know, they've got some good technology here. But then we look at the products or the products that we think about, and the competition is catching up. You know, you look at things like, you know, yes, some of the top end cars that, you know, the Model S's and the Model X's are super fast cars. You know, they are performance cars. But Volkswagen are now bringing out cars. You know, Volkswagen has launched something called the ID4, which is effectively, you know, it's an SUV. It's like a sort of electric Tiguan. And Tesla has got the Model Y, which is the SUV version of the Model 3. So it's a similar size car. They're in a similar price bracket, and they have similar battery range in terms of mileage. So, you know, from the customer's point of view, what's the difference? You know, you look at the interiors of a Tesla, and they're really bland. You know, if you look at the price point that a Tesla is in, you know, you're starting at sort of 40-45K mark if you're a UK consumer. And, you know, that's sort of the current price bracket for, you know, drivers of premium German cars. And, you know, they're used to quite nice interiors. And you don't get a nice interior, I don't think, in a Tesla.
No, I think I've got a nice interior in my Mazda 3, which I got secondhand for 13K.
Yeah, Mazda 3, yeah.
It's lovely. And, you know, I don't like Teslas. I mean, from what I've seen, I mean, you know, this is a very personal view, but I look at them and see a Mondeo. I don't see much different in terms of the styling. And for the money, I think, you know, it's extravagant beyond belief, just for the electric side of things. And my understanding, which I think was explored in our big cover feature on EVs this week, is that they're not very reliable either.
No, you go onto the internet. I mean, you can go onto the internet and find anything to suit your argument, and you can go onto any car forum on the internet and you'll find people slating whatever brand you want. But there, you know, you go on a Tesla and there's a lot of grumpy people about, you know, paint quality, build quality, doors that aren't lined up, batteries that die after 2 days. Now they may be exceptions, but you know, I start asking myself, you know, what is special about this? Because the thing about this is, no doubt that electric vehicles are the future. There's a growth market. What needs to be taken into account here is, how does the industry structure of electric car vehicles evolve? Does it evolve in a way that you end up with a dominant player that has an advantage over everybody else, so they can do it cheaper and or better, and therefore earn, you know, monopoly profits or supernormal profits? And I'm not convinced there is. You know, I was reading something last week, a really interesting article about, quite in-depth article, you know, the Chinese now are making really good electric cars. There's a brand called NIO, which is, you know, across the range of electric vehicles, and it wants to come to the European market in the next 5 years. Now, I'm not sure whether European consumers are ready yet to buy Chinese cars, but, you know, we're looking at a market that is evolving and changing very quickly. Now, granted that Tesla doesn't have the baggage that the traditional car makers have with, you know, all the debt, all the cost of, you know, petrol and diesel and that kind of thing. But, you know, these companies are fierce competitors. And, you know, you look at the valuation of this thing. This is a company that's worth, I don't know, $780 billion. And it made $2 billion in operating profit last year. And about 1.5 billion dollars were regulatory credits, emissions credits. And, you know, okay, that's part and parcel of the business model. But it's currently having a big influence on overall level of profits. And, you know, as deliveries go up, they'll get more of these, but it'll become less of a sort of a factor.
Well, but presumably, I mean, those credits, I mean, because it manufactures green vehicles, it gets these credits. But as the industry does shift to EVs, then presumably more and more car companies will also get these credits. Presumably, as sustainability becomes more commonplace across the industry as a whole, other companies in other industries will generate these credits. Presumably, they won't be as valuable in the future when every company is green.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
So it's got to at some point make money out of his cars. And you know, is there anything in the numbers that you see that says, okay, that's good, that's moving in the right direction, that's the trajectory you want to see? There is a possibility that it can live up to its valuation at some point.
No. but I do think, you know, that's not to say that it can't grow its profits significantly from here. I think it can. You know, there's a lot of development in the pipeline. You know, you have two new factories coming on stream this year, and production and deliveries, you know, they're talking very bullishly. They're talking about growing deliveries by 50% a year for the next few years, but they need to, you know, they're only making half a million cars a year. Toyota's delivering 9 million. And so they need to ramp up production, but you know, the market will get more crowded. You know, you look at markets like Norway. I read an article on Norway the other day, and you know, Volkswagen is the leader. Tesla is not the leader in this market. And I just think that it's all very well. And I think, you know, a lot of the share price has come from, you know, short squeezes. You know, people have tried to bet heavily against Tesla because it's overvalued, and they've got burnt. And you've just seen a monumental short squeeze, which has driven the share price higher. But, you know, I think one of the things that you want to see as an investor, you know, over a reasonable period of time, is you want to see valuations track profits or cash flows, broadly speaking. Now, you have a problem when you've got companies that aren't making any money. And I just think that, you know, it's been taken for granted, and more so, that Tesla has won this industry, it's all over. That's what the market capitalization is telling you. I think it's already handed the gold medal out to Tesla, and I don't think we're there. You know, there's no doubt there's some very clever technology in here, but we know we're getting to a situation where we've been having this debate for a long time, you know, the last few years about business performance and the value the stock market puts on it. And you can accept in a low interest rate world that certain companies can have high valuations. I think that acceptance and that argument has been accepted. But that's a different kettle of fish from taking, you know, companies now and pricing them as winners because they may or may not change an industry. And I think that, you know, this is gone from investing to not gambling. I think the people who have bought Tesla, who are and long Tesla, have taken a great deal of time and diligence in examining the markets and examining its business model, and they've come to a view, and that view may be right, but it's a question of what price, and I think that the price is way, way, way in excess of what this company probably can achieve. But you know, when you live in a zero interest rate world, you know, the value of the future in today's money is a lot higher than it used to be, and the market doesn't want to ask questions like this. It's just you know, there is a love affair with these kind of companies.
Mm. We as I say, have written this, or Nilushi, Karuna Ratne and Alex Hamer have written a fantastic piece looking across the EV market this week, and you know, just going back to your point about Tesla being awarded the gold medal for winning to electric cars. I mean, there are so many companies mentioned in this report. You know, as you say, major car manufacturers. Yeah, it does look premature. What this report does is offers lots and lots of different ways of looking at how you can play the electric car theme. So, you know, you've got batteries themselves. You've got, you know, sort of software and technology that goes into them. You've got the sort of miners who are producing the kind of raw materials needed to make them. So, you know, that picks and shovel approach seems to actually perhaps be a better way of playing this industry without having to pick the winner. But I'll leave our readers to pick that one up in their own good time. 8 pages worth. It's a big one. Should we talk about booze? Because Diageo have had some numbers out this week, as have Fevertree. What do these look like? And the pubs are still shut. It can't be great for them.
No, it's not great for them. But I actually think that both companies put out pretty reassuring numbers, actually. I think both companies have done very well with the cards that they've been dealt. And what's clear, I think, you know, the takeaway, which is relevant to both companies, is that the North American spirits market is firing very nicely. There are some sort of non-sort of demand-related issues. There's been a lot of restocking by US retailers, which has brought forward orders for spirits. And there's been, you know, shift. This is an industry where stocking and destocking can introduce some volatility into the results from time to time. But at the moment, the trends are favourable, and you know, Diageo has you know, shown what I think why a lot of people view it as a very dependable long-term investment. It hasn't escaped the carnage, but you know, it's if you just look at its revenues were actually down by about 4.5%, and its profit margin was still over 32%, and this is when pubs and bars and things like airport retail, which is where they make very rich, much richer margins, are essentially closed. And I think this was an extremely, extremely good result.
I was going to say, it's an extraordinary performance, really, in the circumstances, given how exposed to the on-trade they actually are, to the bar and leisure industry. It's massive.
Well, if we remember a year ago, you know, Diageo was one of the first companies that came out and reported and actually gave us a feeling of the damage that coronavirus and lockdown could do to their profits, because they were taking a hit of about 300 million just on their Chinese business alone. And, you know, we move on a year and they've done really well. And, you know, I don't think the shares look too expensive either. You know, if you look at, you buy Diageo for about 24 times next year's earnings. Yeah, if you look at the valuation of, you know, some of the American spirits companies like, you know, Brown-Forman, which trades on, you know, a much higher multiple, I think Diageo looks pretty good.
It's a company I've always liked, and not just because I'm a big fan of its products. It has always been a very well-run company. I mean, you know, 24 times earnings, presumably that's kind of based on the possibility that pubs and bars and air travel continues to remain heavily restrictive for the foreseeable future.
No, I think some recovery. I think obviously some recovery is factored into this, but that's not getting back to 2019 levels of profitability. My guess is that, just looking at the forecast, is that analyst forecasts are probably based on some form of opening up this year.
Fingers crossed.
But you know, But Brown Forman's on 40 times earnings.
Yeah, that's a big gap. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that Diageo is trading at such a discount?
I don't know. I think Brown Forman is more of a play on the North American spirits market. And I think the North American spirits market has been doing very well, and there's been little to offset it. Whereas, you know, Diageo obviously has a beer business in Guinness, which is doing really quite badly with all the pubs shut, and you know, blows a hole and it offsets. You know, offsets the performance of the American market. I mean, North America is about 40% of business. I mean, Brown Forman is a global business, and you know, in Jack Daniels, it's got, you know, an incredibly strong brand, but you know. Maybe there's a UK stock market discount in there.
It does, you know, feel like it.
Yeah, and I just think, you know, the valuation gap between, you know, between those two companies looks too big. One of them isn't right.
Probably the answer lies somewhere in the middle. It usually does. Well, should we quickly turn to Fevertree that you've also written about? We haven't spoken about Fevertree for quite some time. It was always a contentious one, and it was a valuation thing that we couldn't really get our head around, and the potential in the US, which was obviously a big factor in why that valuation looks so rich. How's it getting on out there? Is the spirits market working for it as well as it is for Diageo?
I would say yes, but I also think that the company deserves a lot of credit for the things that it's been doing in America. You know, it put in a distribution agreement a couple of years ago. I think it went in. My concern with Fevertree is that its product's too expensive, and I still think it's too expensive. And I think it went into America with the wrong price point. And it refers to this as price optimization, which is just, you know, management speak. But you know, essentially, I mean, I read it as that, you know, they've cut their prices, and it's been the right thing to do. And they've got, you know, nearly 60% increase in off-trade sales in America. And they're also selling over the internet there very well. They're getting into the supermarkets, and they're exploiting the trend. Tequila is on an absolute tear. And you see that in the Diageo figures. And Fevertree has been positioning its business and its drinks at the tequila market. It's doing well, and the other good thing, the other really big improvement that we've seen here is Fevertree operates an outsourced business model, so it doesn't make and bottle the drinks. They're outsourced to a third party. And what it's been doing up until very recently is essentially putting bottles of mixers in containers and on container ships and shipping them across from the UK to the US. That's expensive, and it also takes some time. And now what they've got is they've partnered up with a bottler on the West Coast. That's going to make all their drinks for it in America and bottle them and send them off to the shops and to the bars. And that's a really significant move, because it's going to take out those shipping costs, and it's going to also reduce delivery time. So they're going to be able to give better customer service. So the American business, it's difficult to know what's going on. There was quite a slowdown in second half growth.
Overall, the sales are up about 23%, and they were up 38% in the first half and only 11% in the second half. But, you know, with all these lockdowns, it's difficult to get a handle what's going on. But there has been quite a slowdown in the growth rate in America in the second half of the year. You need to keep an eye on that, see what's going on into the new year. The other big success has been in Australia and Canada, where sales have been extremely strong. So, you know, we're looking at a business now that's going to have come out of 2020 making similar kind of sales that it made last year. The issue will be is obviously what happens opening up in the UK. I think the UK was showing signs of plateauing even before COVID came along. And I think this is why what they're doing in Europe, in America, and places like Australia and Canada going well is a positive, because it rebalances the business away from the UK, which is what it needed to do. I still think the shares are expensive. You know, they're on 50 times next 12 months.
I was going to say, I mean, that looks like a valuation which demands perfect execution, and there's a lot that can go wrong here.
Yeah, it still looks overvalued to me, but I think from a business point of view, if we just look at what they're doing with the business, I think they're doing a good job. And again, this is the issue you have. You know, you have good businesses, and you know, the stock market puts them on very rich valuations. And I think, you know, the problem for Fevertree now is that, you know, it went through a phase where it was riding the wave of a gin boom in the UK, which led to regular upgrades in analyst forecasts and the share price going through the roof. That isn't there at the moment, and I don't know whether it's going to come back. My guess is it possibly won't come back. And this needs to almost like grind it out now. And whilst I think that, you know, this is a business that in normal terms can do fairly decent levels of, you know, of earnings and cash flow growth, I'm not convinced that marries up to the current valuation price on the shares. But, you know, hats off to what it's been doing. I think, you know, it's faced a very difficult situation. And, you know, looking at the business, you think, they're moving in the right direction. At a different price, you would feel much more optimistic on it as an investment.
Yeah, absolutely. Although you have other options, including Diageo, which is a different price. If I had to pick between the two, I'd go for that, I have to say. Any day of the week. But hey, that's just my opinion. Cheers, Phil. That's been it's been a pleasure talking to you, as always. I'm off for a week now, so I think you're going to be in the company of James Norrington next Friday. But I hope you have a great week. And I'm going to run away from these crazy markets because I can only see it ending badly.
What a great way to end.
Well, we had 2 weeks of positivity, Phil. Let's leave that there for a while. Have a great weekend, Phil, and thank you everyone for listening.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.